are at least 75 classified sleep disorders, many of which wouldn't have been considered disorders before the invention of the light bulb. The man who invented the CPAP machine, which is used to treat sleep apnea, was a creative mind who just happened to find a new use for a vacuum cleaner. And sleeping pills may not help you get to sleep faster, but they work by erasing your short-term memory. I'm Lindsay Moon, and today on Focus, we're going to talk about sleep science, what we know and what we don't. David Randall, author of the book Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep, which is now out in paperback, will be here. He says the more you know about sleep, the more its strangeness unnerves you. We'll talk about why. Coming up after this news. Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon, in for Jim Meadows. We spend nearly a third of our lives asleep, but have you ever wondered why and what life would be like if we didn't? This hour on Focus, we're going to talk about what we know about sleep and what we don't. David Randall is joining me. He's author of the book Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep, which is now out in paperback. He's a senior reporter at Reuters and is an adjunct professor at New York University. He's been published in the New York Times, New York Magazine, and Forbes. He's also a sleepwalker, but we'll get to that a little later in the hour. David Randall, welcome to Focus.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Before we get started, I do want to let our listeners know that this is a pre-recorded episode of Focus. So while we aren't taking live calls this hour, we still do want to hear from you. Have you ever sleepwalked? Have you ever wondered why you dream or what they mean? Send us a tweet at Focus580 or post on our Facebook page. So, David, after reading Dreamland, I know that this is totally a loaded question, but why do we sleep?
That is the biggest question. That is also so far unanswerable. Scientists know so many things about what happens if we don't sleep. We know that, you know, your mind will turn against you, your body system will basically go haywire. But we don't know why we and every other animal on Earth sleeps. It's one of those big mysteries, and it's something that one famous biologist said, that if sleep doesn't serve an absolutely vital function, it is the biggest mistake that evolution ever made. And so far, that function is still a mystery.
What are some of the side effects that you found most surprising that happen when you don't get enough sleep?
There are actually several. One of them was that if you don't sleep, the lack of sleep is directly related to weight gain. So as you go longer and longer without sleep, especially, you know, classic sleep deprivation is, you know, if you stay up for more than 24 hours, or if you consistently get less than 6 hours of sleep a night, your body will start to develop this very intense craving for carbohydrates. And then you'll tend to eat more, and then your body also won't, therefore, burn it off in the way that you'd hope. So that's one thing. Another thing is that sleep deprivation, there was one study by the Australian military, of all things, that basically looked at the ability of someone who was sleep-deprived to function. And the comparison they used was to people who were drunk. So essentially they had two people sit down. One person was drunk, legally drunk, and the other person just had stayed up for more than 24 hours, so classic sleep deprivation. And they found that the person who was drunk performed better on tasks. They're better able to keep a running list of things in their memory. They're made better decisions. They basically just performed better overall, which is something that you wouldn't necessarily think. And then I guess the other huge surprising thing was just what happens to your mind the longer you go without sleep. One of my favorite stories is in the 60s, there was this teenager in San Diego, Randy Gardner, who decided he wanted to break the Guinness World Record for staying awake continuously. And the Guinness World Record book no longer keeps these type of records because they don't want people to basically do crazy, scary things to themselves in hopes for breaking a record.
Right.
But he stayed awake 11 straight days. And a sleep researcher from Stanford, who actually just happened to read about it in the paper beforehand, flew down and tracked him the whole time. So he actually, you know, it was scientifically, he did stay awake. And by the end of it, Gardner, who was, you know, a white teenager, he thought he was the black running back for the San Diego Chargers.
How long was the record that he was trying to break? Did he end up breaking it?
He did break it. He stayed awake for 11 straight days. The record before that was, it was kind of good on and off, but it was around 5 or 6 days, and that was by a DJ for a radio station in New York, but he was fueled largely by speed. So Gardner did it without anything else.
Staying awake for more than 24 hours is, like, you start to nod off. It's really difficult to do that. Did he have a team of people that were staying up with him and poking him whenever he started to doze?
He did. He had the sleep researchers from Stanford actually helped out, too. So, you know, they would write about things like, you know, playing basketball with him in the middle of the night. And he had a team of people who basically said, you know, I'll help you stay up. But as he went longer and longer, he started to turn on these people. And he started saying, why are you doing this to me? He started to act more aggressively. He basically lost control of himself.
After he got done with the experiment, had broken the record, and went to sleep, when he woke back up again, was he back to normal, his normal self?
It took a while. I think when he first fell asleep, he slept for more than 15 hours continuously. And then over the next month or so, he continued sleeping. He was still sleeping long time, you know, 12 hours or more. But within a month, his sleep was back to normal overall, and there were no long-term effects, which is actually one of the stranger things about sleep, is that you can go from your mind literally turning on itself to being completely fine 14 hours later. It's almost like an acid trip or something like that, and it's all completely something that your brain does to itself.
Speaking of people staying awake and not being able to fall asleep, so intuitively, I guess it makes a lot of sense that sleep patterns changed a whole lot with the invention of the light bulb, but I had never really thought about the ways that technology influences sleep before. Will you talk a little bit about first and second sleep?
Sure. So we naturally are built to go to sleep. Our bodies are naturally built for the light cycle of the sun. So our brains don't interpret... If our brains see bright lights, the only thing we think of them is, you know, this must be sunlight, because, you know, for 10,000 or more years, that's been the only thing that runs the show. But as we've had, you know, electric lights, technology, especially, you know, iPads and computer screens, that blue light mimics sunlight, it tells our brain subtly, you know, this is daylight, you should stay awake longer and longer. So it makes it harder for someone to actually fall asleep. And then, so there's also a history professor at Virginia Tech who also decided to say, you know, what happens, what's been the effect of all this light, and how has sleep changed? So he went back and looked at things like the Canterbury Tales. He looked at old diaries, records, everything else from the 16th and 1700s, and he saw that the sleep patterns were completely different. So we used to, you know, people back then used to fall asleep when the sun went down, so around, you know, 6:30 or 7 or so, and then they'd stay asleep until about 1:30 or 2 in the morning. Then they would naturally wake up, and then they would stay awake for about an hour or so, and then go back to bed. And this was known as the first and second sleep. And in this time in between, when they were awake, that was when, you know, they would think about their dreams, they would talk with their loved ones, they would, you know, do whatever else you might want to do in the middle of the night. And then go on back to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, what's interesting is that there have been studies where, you know, modern people are sequestered away from bright lights, and within a couple of days, they'll naturally go back into the same cycle. So it suggests that we're kind of built to wake up in the middle of the night. And, you know, so if you find yourself waking up at 2 in the morning, it might not be a sign of insomnia. It might just be a sign of that's what your body is meant to do.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting when I was reading, because now, you know, it's common for people to wake up at 3 a.m. and just be wide awake and think, oh, well, now I'm just awake, I should just stay awake. And that's, you know, a disorder. At least it's considered a disorder. Were there any other examples of cultural change in the ways that we think about sleep that you found while researching this book?
One other big one is the siesta, basically, which is still popular in some Latin American countries. It's actually surprisingly popular in China, which is something I didn't know about before I started working on this book, that many state workers who work for state-owned companies in China do get essentially a siesta in the afternoon, and some Western managers come in and see people sleeping at their desks and are totally confused, basically. But it's also part of what's called our circadian rhythm. So, you know, our bodies have this natural rhythm of when it's time to wake up and when it's time to get sleepy. And this changes throughout your lifetime, too. So, you know, when you're a teenager, it seems like it's almost impossible to wake up before 8 a.m. And that's because it literally is almost impossible for your body to wake up that early. But as you get older, that shifts. But for most everybody, no matter what age you are, you know, you tend to be awake by 9 or 10 or so in the morning. And then you can stay that way, and then you naturally get sleepy around 2 o'clock or so. And a lot of people think that this is, oh, because I had a big lunch or something else. It's not. It's just it's a time your body naturally has a dip, and they call it circadian dip. That happens for about an hour, hour and a half. And you can kind of get this extra shot of energy around 5 p.m. or so, and that takes you till when you fall asleep, maybe 10 or 10:30. And scientists have actually found that during certain times in the circadian rhythm, you can actually perform better physically. So at 6:30 or so, 6 to 6:30, that's actually the peak of your physical abilities. Scientists have found that, you know, late weight lifters can lift a little bit more weights, sprinters can run a little bit faster, long jumpers can jump a little bit farther. So sports trainers and Olympic trainers are now trying to use this as an advantage. But in terms of siesta, it was also a kind of cultural thing that after the invention of the light bulb, people basically thought, oh, wow, we are no longer tethered to the sun. We can work all night long with no side effects. And, you know, Thomas Edison famously thought that anybody who slept for more than 4 hours a night was basically lazy and could not contribute to society. But as that's been shifted and we've had this abundant light, we've seen, you know, more incidents of diseases that are correlated with an abundance of light, whether they're certain types of cancer, whether they're stroke and heart attack, or whether they're simply accidents from people staying up for too long.
I thought it was really interesting, the part of the book where you were talking about the invention of the light bulb and the work ethic part of that, because I saw a lot of parallels there between, you know, the invention of the computer, the internet started to become a thing. Everyone thought, oh, everything's going to get so much easier now. And now it just turns out that there's, in some professions at least, more work to do than before.
Exactly. It's kind of like a Pandora's box. It's, wow, we have all this available time. We're going to use it for good. And then it's not always used for good. You know, it's suddenly you're sitting there, you know, at your work computer, and you're able to do the work of what three people used to do. But it's, you know, now you have the work of three people. It's not necessarily a good thing. And this happens too, you know, everywhere, to even to the military. You know, some of the new ships that the Navy has, there are now 150 sailors on them, where before it was 300 or 400. Because technology has allowed the work to be consolidated. You know, it doesn't take as many people to do everything. But that actually leads to more danger that, you know, say the person who's operating the computer or whatever else, they don't have as much backup. When they're sleep-deprived, whatever mistake they make can have more ramifications. They're jumping without a net.
So nobody would ever say, if you were on the job, you don't need to take a break to go eat. But people don't take sleep seriously. Do you think that if we knew biologically why we sleep, in addition to what the side effects are if we don't, that people might pay more attention? I mean, you say in the book that there's no documented cases where anyone has ever died from a lack of sleep.
I think there would be. But I think it's complicated. I think if we knew more about sleep, it would, if we know the biological reasons for sleep, it would give more justification. But one thing that's hard about sleep is that it's hard to see the effects. You know, when someone's actually sleeping, you know, they're just lying there. They're in a dark room, and everyone thinks, you know, I can just push myself harder. If I drink some caffeine, I can really do this. I don't need sleep. It's almost become a sense of pride, and a sense of something you have to do, whether even, you know, maybe it's not pride, but you have to do it whether you want to or not, because you have so many demands. You know, you're working, you're also coming at home and taking care of your kids and taking care of your house and everything else. You know, there's a lot of demands on you at one time, so you might want to sleep and you simply just don't have time to. But it's not, you know, something, it's one of those things too that even people who should really know better don't give sleep as much respect as it probably deserves. In the And, you know, the U.S. military knows more about the human body than probably any organization on Earth. And even then, in 2003, in the invasion of Iraq, literally tanks on the way to Baghdad were going off the side of the road because the person driving was falling asleep. Because before the invasion, you know, commanders were saying, you know, we have to go speed as our greatest asset. So soldiers were only sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night before they went on their mission. That's changed now. You know, the military now says, well, okay, we realize that the lack of sleep will lead to all these accidents and is now thought to be a leading cause of friendly fire. So we're going to take steps to basically not harm ourselves. And as opposed to our greatest asset being speed, our greatest asset is going to be the minds and decision-making abilities of our soldiers.
And there's a wrist monitor that plays a role there.
Exactly. So it's basically like a wristwatch that you wear, and it tracks how long someone has, how much sleep someone has been getting. So the idea isn't just to say, okay, we all need to get 8 hours of sleep. It's also able to be used strategically. So, you know, say you're a commander in the field and you're going to send a group of men and women on a mission. You can say, okay, we know that collectively, you know, you've been getting this much sleep, or individually you've been getting this much sleep. And not only that, we know when you're going to get tired and when your decision-making ability is going to falter. So therefore, we're going to either say you need to take a nap now, or you need to sleep at a certain time, or we're going to administer some kind of drugs to help you stay awake and try to counteract that sleep. So sleep is now thought of as something as vital as, you know, bullets and food and water. And it always was as vital. It was just never got the respect.
Are soldiers wearing those wristwatch type things now, or when will those start being a part of everyday life in the military?
Those are still being tested, but the estimates are that by around the year 2020, so in 7 years or so, they're supposed to be a pretty standard part of a soldier's gear.
Do you see those types of devices expanding into the private sector also?
They definitely could be, especially in certain industries, you know, like pilots, like, you know, anything to do with transportation or energy, especially because that's kind of a 24-hour business. One other thing would probably be truckers, you know, long-haul truckers. That, you know, trucking is probably one of the hardest jobs you can do because it's, you know, constant toll on your brain. You always have to be paying attention. It's a constant toll on your body. You can't get up and move around anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Constant deadline pressure. You're not necessarily, you don't have access to the best food or exercise. So as a result, many truckers have pretty severe sleep apnea. And that is then thought to be, you know, a major contributor to fatal accidents. So if sleep was tracked, and especially not only sleep, but the usage of CPAP devices, which basically sleep apnea essentially is you suffocate yourself while you're sleeping unknowingly. So CPAP device basically is a mask that goes over your face and creates a vacuum so your throat doesn't fold in on itself. If it tracked the usage of that, that would probably do a huge amount to make the highways safer.
As you bring up sleep apnea, when I started reading the book, I almost was waiting for the chapter on sleep apnea, but I did not expect it to open the way that it did. I think the first line is, "This is a tale of how an Australian man with a vacuum cleaner fixed a mistake in evolution." Can you talk a little bit about the invention of the CPAP machine?
Sure. So sleep apnea itself is, you know, it's, as I was saying, it's basically you start suffocating yourself in your sleep unknowingly. And it had been identified in the mid 1950s, and it basically was called Pickwickian syndrome, which is this reference to a Charles Darwin book, where this extremely fat character can just fall asleep while standing up.
Mm-hmm.
And researchers started to find out, you know, what's going on here, and they realized that it wasn't. You know, there's all these different theories about what was causing it. But then, you know, lo and behold, it turned out that it was basically a flaw in the blueprint of our bodies. We have a longer tongue than any other our tongue goes longer back into our throat proportionally than any other animal, and it's only us and dogs with pushed-in faces, like, you know, pugs, that can develop sleep apnea. And it's basically a trade-off for the ability to talk and have, you know, verbal language. So one of the inventors of the CPAP device, he reasoned that, you know, by having continuous airway pressure, you're able to prevent the throat from closing in on itself. And he built the prototype out of a vacuum cleaner engine. And one of the first people who used it, you know, they attached the hose to basically a scuba mask and put it on his face, and it was so loud that he cut a hole in his bedroom wall and put the engine part, the vacuum cleaner part, into his garage and just had the hose coming through. And it was so powerful, too, that the mask created all these bruises around his face. But it was so, but he was able to stand that. You know, he was able to walk around with bruises all over his face because it was so useful for him. He basically said he was able to sleep deeply for the first time ever in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Because sleep apnea, you know, there's different kinds, but the main kind of sleep apnea, you can wake up, you know, every 6 minutes, 8 minutes, choking yourself all through the night, and you wake up for maybe 10 seconds or so. It's not long enough to actually be captured in your memory, but you're basically gasping for air. Your blood pressure is going crazy. It's thought to be a major contributor to fatal heart attack and stroke. And when someone actually... you know, then you're always tired. So you might sleep and stay in bed for 8 hours, wake up the next day, think, man, why am I so tired? I was sleeping for 8 hours. You weren't really sleeping. You're choking yourself all night. So once you're able to actually get into deep sleep, it's life-changing. One of the first people who used the CPAP device, it was actually a kid in Australia. The inventor was Australian, too. And he was having trouble in school, and people actually thought, you know, maybe teachers had identified him as special needs. But then he was able to use the CPAP device, and he was finally able to actually sleep, and then he was finally able to actually pay attention in class. So it was life-changing.
Mm-hmm. And I knew sleep apnea was, there were a lot of people who suffer from that condition, or at least sleep with CPAP machines because it helps them sleep better, but I did not realize that how big of an industry that is.
Oh, it's huge, and it's growing, too. So about one in every three people is thought to have some form of sleep apnea, and much of it is correlated to obesity. So if you think about it, you know, if you have fatty tissues in your throat, it's more likely for your throat to close up, especially if you're sleeping on your back or something. So it's not only in the U.S., but it's one of the biggest growing markets is in China. You know, a lot of people in the U.S. don't realize this, but China has just as bad of an obesity epidemic as the U.S. You know, it's only been over the last 20 years or so, too, that Western fast food has become very popular. You know, KFC, its biggest market, actually is in China. And that, along with the one-child policy, has led to, you know, overindulgence, basically. So there's more... a greater number of people with obesity, and therefore a greater number of people suffering from sleep apnea.
While we're talking about sleep aids and other things, you also bring up another device called the Sleep Coach that you discovered while researching the book, and you actually used it yourself. Can you tell me about what the Sleep Coach is and how it works?
Sure. So it's this device called the Zio Sleep Coach, and what it essentially is a brainwave monitor that you wear on your forehead and sleep with. It has this band, so it kind of makes you look like Conan the Barbarian or something. And it's like this one-inch square plastic box, basically. It's very thin, so it's not really a box, so more a band, that goes right between your eyes and your forehead. And while you're sleeping, it basically just tracks to see what stage of sleep you're in, you know, how much time you're spending in dreaming sleep, how much time you're spending in non-REM sleep. So what this means to do is to give us data. That's the one big question mark with sleep. It's very hard to say, okay, ask yourself, you know, 2 weeks ago on a Thursday, how well did you sleep? You really have no idea. You're going to guess. It's not like food where you can say, okay, I want to lose weight, so I'm going to track how much food I'm eating, or I'm just going to, you know, eat healthier in some way. Sleep is a big black box for most of us. And this is, even shown in when people go to sleep lab, they might go there and, they're hooked up to all the devices and everything, all the monitors. They fall asleep and they wake up, 6 hours, 7 hours later, and they tell the technician, "Well, I did not sleep at all last night." And the technician can literally point to the computer monitor and say, "Well, I know you fell asleep at this time, and I know you woke up at this time. You were sleeping for 7 hours." Mm-hmm. And the person has no idea. He or she just thinks this vague idea of how much I slept last night or didn't.
Right. So even if you wanted to try and track it yourself, you really can't, because it's an unconsciousness thing.
Exactly. So what the Zio does is it tracks it and then tells you how much or how little sleep you're getting. So basically it allows you to quantify this mystery and say, okay, I now know how much sleep I'm getting, and I also know what goes into it. I know that if I drink coffee at 5 in the afternoon, I don't sleep as well or I don't sleep as deeply. I know that if I, watch TV or I watch Breaking Bad right before I fall asleep, I don't spend as much time in dreaming sleep or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And so it kind of works by giving you a score and, like, rating the quality of your sleep?
Exactly. So they call it the ZQ, and it's basically a 1 to, I think, 120 scale or 1 to 100 scale. And, the more time you spend in deep sleep, the better your ZQ is. I never got that high personally. I mean, I have sleep disorders anyway, and I kick and I talk and everything else. It's almost comforting to say, I know how well I'm sleeping, and I know I can point to something. It's not just this kind of fuzzy idea. It kind of takes the mystery out of it.
I'm Lindsay Moon, and you're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm talking this hour with David Randall about his book Dreamland. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back. This is Focus. Stay with us. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon, and this hour I'm talking with David Randall about his book Dreamland, which is now out in paperback. So, David, before the break, we were talking about a few gadgets that are supposed to help people sleep, but I also want to talk about sleeping pills.
The guy who created the first sleeping pill was also the person who discovered that diabetes was a malfunction of the pancreas. You share an anecdote about how when he discovered that the pancreas was responsible for diabetes, he cut out his dog's pancreas and just waited to see what happened. But you never really write how exactly he figured out what is going to help people sleep. I hope that it was a less violent story.
It was a less violent story. So he basically discovered some of the compounds that went into their first sleeping drug, which they called Verona, I believe. Essentially turned the brain off, but it didn't work in the ways that people expected. So what it would do, it would help you fall asleep, but the scary thing was that the amount between what a regular dose was and what a fatal dose was not very large. if you took too much, which it was also addicting, or if you combine it with alcohol, which people naturally tend to do, it could have very strong side effects, including death. Sleeping pills also, even modern sleeping pills, are not as effective as most people think they are. Studies have shown that, someone who takes a sleeping pill will probably fall asleep about 10 minutes faster than someone who doesn't, and maybe stay asleep for about 10 minutes longer. So it's not this life-changing thing. How most modern sleeping pills work, such as Ambien and Lunesta, they essentially make it so your brain can't form short-term memories. So you might be tossing and turning all night long, but you wake up and it's a big blank spot. So you think, okay, I was sleeping the whole time, because that time that you were tossing and turning wasn't captured in your memory. So that's why you hear stories of people who are on Ambien who, wake up with a broken arm or wake up and find food cooking on their stove or, bite marks on on pieces in their freezer. They were doing all these things, and they just simply don't remember it the next day.
I was also really interested in the fact that you shared that when people started taking sleeping pills, it spread almost as rapidly as people signed up for Facebook accounts.
It did. Pretty soon there were it was very, very common to find sleeping pills in someone's medicine cabinet, and it still is. There's about 60 million prescriptions written for sleeping pills each year. We're in a country of about 300 million people. So one of the things that happens with sleeping pills, too, is that there's a big psychological aspect of it. You know, it's not only the fact that whatever help the sleeping pill does or does not give you in falling asleep, it also is people think of it as a crutch, saying, you know, I have to have the sleeping pill to fall asleep. So even most sleeping pills are prescribed for short-term use. People tend to use them over the long run and then have a very hard time getting off of it. And part of that is insomnia is considered almost an ironic condition. You know, most people want sleep so badly that they can't get it. You know, they sit there and they focus on, okay, if I fall asleep right now, I can get 7 hours of sleep. And then it's 15 minutes later and they think they've, you know, messed up their next day already, and then they go into this system, this cycle of anxiety and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of the sleeping pills do is just kind of let somebody say, oh, somebody else is taking care of it and I don't have to worry. But if you can just do that, I don't have to get straight to the I don't have to worry part, then you don't really need the sleeping pill.
Right. And some of the studies that are cited show that things like progressive relaxation are more effective long term than taking a sleeping pill.
Exactly. So there have been studies that show that, you know, we'll look at people who took sleeping pills or people who took or who went through like a behavioral therapy technique. And for most people who are on sleeping pills, as soon as the prescription runs out, their insomnia or whatever else was happening comes back, because they never really learned how to put themselves to sleep effectively or how to relax. You know, one philosopher said that sleep is almost like a bird that sits on your hand that'll stay there as long as you don't look at it. So it's, you know, people who continually want to look at the bird, it keeps on flying away. It gets harder and harder.
I was comforted by the section in the book where you talk about schools that had changed schedules to be more accommodating to the ways that teenagers' bodies naturally get sleep. I mean, I was really involved in high school and was just exhausted all the time. And it was interesting to read about how the times that your body naturally wants you to sleep change. Like someone who's 16, for example, would be very different from someone who's 36.
Exactly. So your circadian rhythm shifts throughout your lifespan. So, you know, it's very hard for a teenager to wake up before 8, whereas for a 60-year-old person, it's very hard sometimes to not be awake at 8. So, you know, in the book I liken it to, you know, when your teenage years is essentially flying in the wrong direction and then suffering for jet lag for 4 years straight. And I suffered through that too. You know, I was involved in sports. I was on newspaper. You know, I was on the, you know, mock trial team. I was very busy. And I always felt like I was exhausted. And, you know, Saturday would come around and I would try to sleep for like 14 or 15 hours. What school districts are doing now is recognizing that, you know, teenagers' bodies really are different. It's not just the fact that they're suddenly growing and going through growth spurts and their voices are cracking and everything else. It's that the time that they can sleep and stay awake is much different than the time that it's optimal for, you know, for their teachers to be awake. So in one school district in Minnesota, they shifted the starting bell time by, you know, an hour or so in the morning, as opposed from 7 a.m., maybe start the first bell at 8:30. And there was a corresponding huge jump in SAT scores. And even the College Board, you know, which runs the SAT, came in and investigated, saying, you know, what was the cause behind this? And they couldn't pinpoint it on anything but the fact that kids were getting more sleep. And, you know, it seems pretty obvious. If you're awake for a class, you're going to learn more. But for so long, it always just was, you know, that's teenagers being lazy or something else. And with this extra time, you know, some parents were worried, okay, if my teenager is going to school now from, I don't know, from 8 to 3 as opposed to from 7 to 1, you know, they're going to have all this extra free time. They're going to get in more trouble or they're not going to be able to be involved in after-school activities and everything else. What researchers found was that teens really were using that extra time to sleep. What was getting, what the trade-off was their, you know, free time in terms of just hanging out. But they actually were using that time effectively.
We talked briefly a couple minutes ago about teaching young kids to sleep, and I also found it interesting that the older you get, it really does get harder to fall asleep. So maybe those, you know, things like progressive relaxation and sleeping pills are, you know, important things to be aware of when you're, as you're getting older.
Exactly. So, you know, many older people especially find themselves waking up in the middle of the night and think, you know, I have some kind of sleep problem. I need to take sleeping pills. Where it is just maybe the second sleep reasserting itself, that you naturally start to wake up more. You know, my father-in-law now, he falls asleep around 9, wakes up in the morning about 1, and stays up for about 2 hours, and goes back to sleep and wakes up around 7. So he's getting enough sleep as he needs. It's just not in this consolidated block like we think we have to, and that's all a misconception.
The book starts with you going to kind of like a sleep support group where people are talking about their dreams. Can you describe being at one of those sessions for me?
Sure. So I went to a couple, and I went into it pretty skeptical that dreams could have any meaning. You know, I thought that the idea that you kind of send coded messages to yourself and in your head throughout the night, and then you had to interpret it with somebody else, sounded like a plot device out of a really bad soap opera. But the people there, I mean, they were all very, very earnest people. And I went to a couple, and generally they tended to be more women than men, tended to be a little bit older. And that could just be the ones who were willing to let a stranger sit in with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I started thinking, okay, I personally think, went into it thinking dreams don't matter at all. You know, they're just a random noise in our head. But then I heard these people talk about, you know, having a dream where they're meeting, they're spending time with their father who passed away 20 years ago, or, you know, spending time with their spouse who also passed away, or their children who passed away. Or, you know, having this long loss, this long recurring dream about somebody they used to know and now they don't have them in their lives anymore. And it was incredibly powerful. You know, it was for these people, dreams mattered. It was them getting in touch with, you know, their deepest feelings and who they felt they were. And, you know, when somebody says this is incredibly meaningful for me, who am I or any scientist to say, you know what, you're wrong. That's not meaningful.
Right.
So, and there actually is some scientific validity to this, too. There's a researcher at UC Santa Cruz who has looked at you know, thousands of dreams, tens of thousands of dreams, and he's done this by basically looking at having people write down what they dreamt about and looking at it as if it was a short story. You know, who are the characters? What was the plot? What happened? And most dreams are by far negative. You know, we tend to dream about the things that worry us. And for people who continually dream about the same thing, you start to see, have a little window of things that they care about or they're worried about or things that continually pop up on their mind when there's nothing else competing for attention.
And there are benefits. I mean, if you're dreaming about something that worries you, there have been examples where there's been a big benefit. You talk about a golfer, for example, that all of a sudden realized a problem with his swing in the middle of the night while he was dreaming and woke up and just knew what was wrong.
Yeah, there's two parts of how dreaming can help you. One is, it can help you come up with new ideas or solve problems, which is, you know, I'm a golfer and I'm trying to do well and I keep on messing up, and then I dream about how I can fix my swing and the next day it comes out and it works out well. Or, you know, Paul McCartney famously, you know, the Beatles needed another song for their album to be complete and he woke up with the melody for Yesterday in his head. You know, he had a problem and his brain essentially solved it while he was sleeping. And then there's also the kind of taking it to the meaning side of dreams. You know, say somebody who comes back from Afghanistan or Iraq and has dealt with PTSD and has these recurring dreams of terror, if there are ways to, and there have been researchers have done this, ways to help him or her take a more active part in what his dreams are. So as opposed to saying, you know, always an audience member of the movie, you start to become a director saying, you know, I'm going to consciously try to dream about this and I'm going to, you know, imagine what I want to see happen. That has been shown to be effective and has been shown to help people kind of get outside the cycle of nightmares. And, you know, recurring nightmares is something that's been a huge issue for returning veterans ever since Vietnam.
I want to talk about sleepwalking because my favorite part of the book, not my favorite, but most interesting, I thought, was the part where you talk about sleep crime. So why researchers think that people sleepwalk is because the part of the brain that is supposed to paralyze your body while you're asleep doesn't necessarily work?
So, yeah. So when you're dreaming, your body essentially, you know, makes it so you can't act out the storyline in your head. But for some people, this doesn't necessarily work. So, you know, your brain goes through five different sleep stages a night. And the main difference is that, you know, REM sleep is when you're dreaming, is when you're essentially paralyzed. And non-REM sleep, which is three or four stages of it, are non-REM sleep, you can move, and you're not dreaming then. But these handoffs aren't always clear. So you might have an overlap of two states at once. You know, so you are in a Venn diagram, you know, you're both in the blue and the red. So you're both dreaming, but you're also able to move for some people. And what this what the end result of this is sleepwalking. You know, so it's sleepwalking is much more common in kids than adults. You know, about one in only about 3% of adults will sleepwalk, but about one in four kids, you know, under 12 will sleepwalk once in their lives. And when you're sleepwalking, basically everything your body's is able to work. You know, your eyes are open. You can walk up and down stairs. You can make movements. You can even do things like drive a car. But your rational part of your brain is asleep. So you can't recognize faces. You can't make good decisions or any real decisions. It's all just rash movements. And this has been shown to, even Shakespeare kind of knew about this. In Lady Macbeth, there's the famous scene where Lady Macbeth is sleepwalking, and one of the attendants of the court says, "Oh, you know, she's sleepwalking. Her eyes are open." And somebody else responds, "Yes, but their senses shut." So even then, they knew that your brain wasn't, your eyes were open, but your brain wasn't working at the time.
Right.
So in criminal cases, it becomes a question of if your body commits a crime, you know, hurts somebody or kills somebody, and there have been real cases where this happens. How liable are you? You know, were you responsible for that, or were you a bystander to something that your body did?
Right. And so one of the examples you give is Ken Parks. Will you tell me about his case?
Sure. So this was in the late 80s, and Ken Parks was a man in Toronto. And he was in a bit of financial trouble. He had been basically embezzling money from his job, and his wife found out and said that the next day he had to go tell her parents and ask for help, or else she was going to leave him and take their daughter with him. So he tries to fall asleep on the couch, and he, that night, gets up and drives 14 miles to his in-law's house and proceeds to let himself in with his key, and he kills his mother-in-law. He stabs her to death and almost kills his father-in-law, you know, beats him over the head with a tire iron and almost chokes him to death.
Mm-hmm.
Then he proceeds to drive to the nearest police station and walk in and say, "I think I've hurt somebody. You know, I think I killed somebody." And look down and see his hands that are cut to the bone, and he's bleeding profusely. And long story short, he is put on trial, and he is acquitted. His lawyers convinced the jury that he had been sleepwalking the whole time. And that pretty much opened the door to what we now think of the, you know, it's more common than you think, but it's not very widely known, as this modern sleep crime, where it becomes this idea of, you know, were you responsible, or were you sleepwalking when you were committing this act? And there have been cases where, you know, someone wakes up and realizes they had a gun on their nightstand and they accidentally shot their girlfriend. And, you know, they have to take her to the emergency room, and it was just an accident. And there have been even tragic cases where, you know, police officers in the middle of the night grab their gun again from their nightstand and accidentally shoot themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this is known as pseudo-suicide, as, you know, an accidental suicide caused while sleepwalking.
The cynical part of my brain, when I was reading about the Ken Parks case, I thought, well, really, that's an ingenious defense, because if you didn't mean to do something or you didn't intentionally do something, you can't really be convicted for it. How do you feel about that? Do you think that you can really do stuff like that while you're asleep?
I think you can. I think that, you know, it's a big question anytime you hear somebody have, you know, I'm blaming this on that, especially a condition as, you know, malingering. Say, well, I had this and this is what the problem was. Or, you know, somebody else hears, oh, that's a great defense, and then decides they're going to use it too. You know, a fisherman in San Diego famously said he stabbed his girlfriend because he was sleepwalking and he dreamt that he was gutting a shark. But the cases where it actually happens are very rare. And Ken Parks, for instance, had a very long family history of sleepwalking, very deeply. His grandfather, for instance, would commonly sleepwalk out into the kitchen and fry eggs on the stove and wake up the next day and not realize what was happening. Ken Parks, when he was 11 or so, tried to sleepwalk out of a window, and his grandmother caught him at the last minute. It's one of those things where there are more shades of consciousness than we typically give our brains credit for or even aware of, and fluke, strange things really do happen.
And a lot of the people who end up sleepwalking and committing crimes really don't have a history of violence at all. When you started researching and learning about those cases, did that scare you at all?
Yeah, it was basically a sum of all fears for somebody who sleepwalks like I do. You know, it's you're terrified to say, what is my body going to get up to tonight that I have no control over? There was last year, the year before, there's the movie Sleepwalk With Me by the comedian Mike Birbiglia, and he has a sleep disorder that caused him to jump out of a window, a second floor window in Washington, and almost kill himself all while sleepwalking. So he now has to, when he goes to sleep, he puts mittens on his hands and then zips himself up in a sleeping bag so he can't move and he can't hurt himself.
You acknowledge your wife in the credits and the help that she offered when you were writing the book. How did she react when you told her about that specific case?
She was terrified. She wanted to know that was not something that I had. But, you know, thankfully my sleepwalking is I talk, I sing, I laugh, I bounce, I walk into walls, but luckily it's not as intense as others. So it's one of those things when you kind of realize, you think, wow, I have something that's really serious, and you realize, okay, with perspective, mine is not as serious because now I realize how serious things can really be.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, too, that there's also, you know, talking about family, there's a genetic component to this, too, that sleepwalking tends to run in families. So when I started working on the book, my dad, he grew up in Kansas, and he was like, oh, yeah, I used to sleepwalk, too. I used to wake up in the cornfield sometimes. And, you know, I was joking around with him, like, that's not sleepwalking, that's an alien abduction.
Was there history beyond just your father?
Not that I know of, but I wouldn't be surprised if it went back more generations. They were on the same family farm in Kansas for several generations, so maybe that's where the crop circles come from. I don't know.
Okay. There is so much information, and there are so many just incredible anecdotes that you found. How long did it take you to write and research it?
It took about a year overall. And luckily, it wasn't as long, you know, as it could be. I mean, I probably could write, if I had enough time, I could have written two books. But one thing that's great about researching sleep is that so many, you know, scientists have spent so much of their time focusing on this, and they don't get to talk about it that much with people. So when you actually call somebody up and tell, you know, I want to know about the history of beds, they will tell you so much, and they will be so generous with their time.
Yeah.
I was very lucky in that regard. You know, I get to talk with people who did things from, you know, research obesity rates in China to the history of beds to how people on submarines sleep to, you know, what happens if you kill somebody while you're sleepwalking.
There's a line at the end of the book in the very last chapter, and you say, the more you know about sleep, the more its strangeness unnerves you. Was there ever a time when you were really getting into the research behind this that you thought, wow, I wish I could just go back and unhave the idea to actually write this?
Yeah, definitely. There were times when it was kind of the Pandora's box of, okay, now I know too much about this, and it's even scarier. You know, it's scary enough to sleepwalk into a wall, which is what I did, and the reason I started working on the book. it's even scarier to realize that there have been many cases of people going to a hotel, checking in, and then sleepwalking out into the hallway and essentially, or sleepwalking off the roof and accidentally killing themselves. Once that thought goes into your brain, it doesn't come out. It was kind of strange to realize there's so much that is just unknown. I would have been much happier writing a book saying, okay, this we know exactly about sleep, and I'm going to answer every single question I have. It's much different to say, okay, I'm going to look at, we know a lot about around the edges, but the exact center of what sleep is, we don't know yet. And this 8 hours of your, third of your life, 8 hours at night you spend, is still fundamentally a mystery. And it's just as mysterious to us as it was to, the ancient Greeks, who, the god of sleep was the brother of the god of death, which kind of shows how spooky they thought the whole thing was.
David, thank you very much for talking with me about Dreamland.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Lindsay Moon, and today on Focus, I've been talking with David Randall. He's author of the book Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep, which is now out in paperback. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be back live. Jim Meadows will be here to talk with WILL's Keepin' the Faith host, Steve Shoemaker. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Jason Croft is our technical director. This is Focus on WILL. Thanks for joining us.